Welcome to Animals Today, your home for serious talk about animals. I'm Dr. Lori Kirschner. The term humane education is one you will hear a lot if you spend any time around animal advocates. But what exactly is humane education? Most of the large animal welfare organizations devote significant resources to humane education, but what really comprises humane education? What are its goals, and what does it achieve? Today, we are very pleased to be speaking to a nationally recognized authority in this area, Bob Ferber. Bob is an attorney and former Los Angeles animal cruelty prosecutor. Plus, he is the founder of Barron's Buddies, where he takes disabled and unwanted rescued animals he rehabilitated to inner city schools to teach empathy, compassion, and nonviolence. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you very much.
I'm so pleased you have agreed to join us and share your experiences and perspectives on what we refer to as humane education. So why don't we start with a definition, Bob?
Okay. And it's not as easy as people would think to define it, because I think people do have different perceptions of it. And I think it's worth starting off by saying the word tends to be overused, and in my opinion, used more broadly than it really was intended. My own definition of humane education, and I think it represents the mainstream view of this, is it's where you're using it. You know what, Lori, this sounds a little strange, but I think I'm going to start by defining what it isn't. It's not something where kids read in a classroom that, you know, this is how you walk your dog, or, you know, and it doesn't mean that can't be a part of it, but it's not about just teaching people or children about how to associate with animals. Humane education is using animals to teach moral and social values that we all kind of believe in, like nonviolence, as you mentioned, and compassion and empathy, by developing relationships with animals. Animals are teachers, and so humane education are different programs that can use a variety of materials, but are usually centered around the bond between animals and people, or the potential bond between animals and people, to bring out positive values that foster good relationships with humans. So in some ways, humane education is about teaching not just humanity or humane approaches towards animals, but even more importantly, humane relationships with other people.
Right. So,
and that's kind of a, you know, complicated, kind of skirts around the issue, but I think as we talk about it a little bit more, you and I, your listeners will understand a little bit better about how humane education comes out and what we mean by that term.
Very good. Bob, how did you get involved in humane education? Tell us a little bit about your history.
Well, it actually started about 14 years ago when I actually was given a very short time to live from a serious cancer. And during that time, I had spent a lot of time with animals. And one of the ways that I dealt with dealing with my cancer was spending time with rescue animals and going to an animal sanctuary that I knew of and working with older and disabled animals. And so it didn't become apparent to me immediately, but as I looked back on it, I realized that this became the relationship that I was developing with these older and disabled and needy animals was teaching me how to deal with my own life and death issues. I found that, for example, the first time when I was told I had cancer, and any of your listeners that have dealt with this or know somebody dealt with cancer, and unfortunately just about everybody's dealt with that or is aware of it, there's a terrible feeling of shock, of loneliness, and of feeling that things are hopeless, and all you can think about is the cancer. And I remember one day I was walking, and I already had a lot of animals at home, so it wasn't that I was completely new to rescuing dogs and cats, but I went to the sanctuary, and I was walking these two old dogs, Sarah and Jesse, and they were really old pit bull, and Jesse and his little girlfriend, Sarah, and they were arthritic, and they could barely walk, And I remember I had been obsessed with my diagnosis of cancer, and couldn't think of anything else for days and weeks. And then I spent this afternoon with Jesse and Sarah taking care of them and helping them and walking with them. And we took this little three-hour walk, and it looked like three old people shuffling along in this little dirt path. It kind of probably looked funny from a distance. And after the 3 hours of just sitting around on the grass with these animals, it dawned on me that I had not thought about the cancer, that I had thought about them, that for the first time since I learned the catastrophic news, I was thinking about somebody else, and in this case, it was Jesse and Sarah. And it literally changed my whole focus about my cancer. And so that was the beginning of me starting to realize that, gee, I know I always loved having dogs and cats at home and visiting other people, and everybody thought, oh, Bob is the crazy dog person that picks up animals off the street. But I had never appreciated how the relationship with animals could impact somebody like it did with me. And in fact, later on, I went and started bringing animals to cancer support communities, and even had one individual, a man that was dying of cancer. And he was very depressed, and I met him through the cancer support group I was going to. And this guy named John, I think he had pancreatic cancer, which is fatal. And he was very depressed, and he had about 8-10 weeks left. And I asked him, and he said that he couldn't find anything to think about except about his cancer. Excuse me. So I asked him if he'd like to go to a Petco or a PetSmart, and we needed volunteers for a mobile adoption. So John, he didn't really want to go, but he reluctantly said, well, I've got nothing else to do, and the facilitator at the group encouraged him to come over to join me. So this Saturday morning, he comes to a PetSmart with this wonderful rescue group I was working with at the time, with Jesse and Sarah, and we're in the lobby, and John shuffles in. He's in a fair amount of pain and discomfort, and I get a chair with a little cushion, and he sits on it, and I hand him an old dog, and I said, you know, your job is to tell people about this dog, and just whatever, and just spend, if you do nothing else, just make this dog's life a little bit better that morning. And it was unbelievable, Lori, beyond anything I could have expected or even the experts at the cancer support group. He came back the next Tuesday and could not stop talking about the change that had happened in him from that Saturday to that Tuesday because of spending 3 or 4 hours on a folding chair with an older dog that needed his help. And he talked about something similar that I had experienced. It had gotten, he had learned about how compassionate these animals were, the emotions that they felt in the lobby of this PetSmart. He saw the relationship between children coming in, looking for animals or bringing their own in to buy dog food or cat food. And he said what I had said, or he had experienced it, that for 3 hours, and in fact he said for the last several days, he had not thought about the cancer. He had thought about those animals and how could he help them again. And I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in that support group room when he was telling us about his experience with that old dog that he was sitting with. And that was, I would say, the very beginning of Barron's Buddies, even though people would ask me to go to schools and talk about my cancer. And I didn't even relate back to these stories I just told you, but I thought, okay, I'll go and tell people about that I survived cancer. And I think there's another story that we can share sometime about how my animals truly did save my life. And I survived the cancer. And I started going to schools to talk about cancer, and some parents thought it would be good for kids to have some reality checks at this very sort of upper class public school in the Palisades. And I realized I don't want to make these kids depressed and bother them, you know, and have nightmares about cancer. So I brought a dog along, and I brought one of my disabled animals, a three-legged shepherd named Trapper. And I brought him into the school, and we started talking about my experiences with cancer and how these animals, including Trapper and Jesse and Sarah, had helped me struggle through this. Well, first of all, it was shocking to find out when I first went into this classroom, I asked the kids how many of them, now this was an elementary and junior high school class, I asked these kids, how many of you know somebody with cancer? Well, I expected a few hands to go up. To my amazement and the teacher's amazement, virtually every hand went up.
Okay, don't go away. After the break, I'm going to ask Bob Ferber how he developed his humane education program.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Krishna. We're talking to Bob Ferber about humane education. Bob, tell us how you developed your humane education program.
Well, as I was telling your listeners, after these experiences of being asked to talk about my cancer and how animals helped me, it started to change from a program of talking about cancer to talking about how these animals had made such a difference. And from that, I had a Rottweiler named Baron von Drooler. And Baron von Drooler was a dog that was an emaciated Rottweiler that people were terrified of. And I also had because it was a Rottweiler, and I had a pit bull named Amy. And Amy was this extraordinary rescue dog, also with one eye, and her teeth had been kicked out, and her lips had been burned, and they had both been severely abused. And then there was the three-legged dog Trapper that lost his leg in a trap. I started bringing these animals to schools, and an extraordinary program kind of developed out of just them being with the kids. To give it a little bit of an example, you can't take a child who's got, let's say, a stutter, and put them in front of the classroom and say to everybody, see, Juan has got a stutter, you should all treat him nicely. It would not be appropriate or work. But you can take a three-legged dog or a disabled animal that nobody wanted, and as children develop, and even adults, develop a bond with this animal, realizing that whether it was a three-legged dog or a supposedly vicious Rottweiler that turns out to be a real drooler on everybody, the children start to identify that differences in each one of us are actually, they're wonderful. And so I started the differences in these disabled and unwanted animals, the children started to identify with their own differences. And the differences could have been anything from a stutter to the fact that everybody in the classroom has different tastes in food. From one kid loves French fries, another one loves broccoli. And also, and of course, more relevant to society is that these kids have different hair color, different skin color, different backgrounds. Some are taller, some are smaller. And so by showing animals that all had differences and had been really rejected by society, you know, as being unwanted, unadoptable animals, these children identified with it, especially in the inner city, as, they could identify as African Americans or the one Asian in the classroom of Hispanics, and feeling that, gee, I don't have to feel alone. In fact, that there's nothing wrong with being different. In fact, the program, Baron's Buddy, started to develop into celebrating all the differences of everybody, that the difference between somebody with red hair or somebody in a wheelchair or somebody that just has regular dark hair or whatever, there's no difference. And that each one of us, one of the favorite things I would talk about was I would bring out to the kids about who's the tallest, who's the shortest, and we would go into things that normally, you're not supposed to talk about that. You're not supposed to say who's bigger or shorter or bigger, wider or thinner. But everybody sees those things. So in my program, we confront these differences and talk about how wonderful they are, that's what makes life wonderful and why we should not, and this leads towards asking children, well, what do we call it when we lump people together that we don't like, or we see somebody who knocks our books down and they have red hair, does that mean that all red hair kids are going to knock my books down? And how does this start? By talking about a Rottweiler that people are afraid of, not because he is vicious, but because kids have had experiences. Oh, I was bitten by a Rottweiler. I was bitten by a pit bull. I heard that pit bulls are really dangerous. Well, does that mean that Amy is dangerous or Baron von Drooler? And the kids would start to realize, no. And then I'd say, well, when you see somebody in the street that's African-American or Caucasian or Asian, and an African-American beat you up in the at lunch hour or stole your books, does that mean that all African-Americans are going to be that way? And we say no. And the kids on their own say no. And then we bring out, what do we call that? Racism, discrimination, prejudice. And then we talk, and so it brings out how wonderful that, you know, even when I, going back to the short and tall, I would ask the kids, what is it that somebody that's extra tall can do that nobody else can do? And usually the kids, the first response is basketball, you know? Could Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Michael Jordan or any of those, Kobe Bryant, be who they are if they weren't 7 feet? Or 6 foot so-and-so, but I remind the kids, what do you think it was like when Kobe Bryant was growing up in school, when he wasn't playing basketball? Do you think people didn't make fun of him? Of course they did. And the kids who were the smallest, people make fun of them, but who goes under, you know, what can somebody that's very small do when we talk about search and rescue? That the heroes of search and rescue, the people who are the, you know, gymnastics, are, there's things that smaller people can do, and that it's so that all of the differences that we that tend to contribute to racism and discrimination and prejudice are things we can celebrate. And you can't teach that, Laurie, in a book. But by bringing an animal in with a difference, with a, you know, something that distinguishes them, that made mainstream society say, oh, we don't like that animal. We don't. The children realized there was no reason for that. And
yeah.
That it translates to people.
Yeah, your Barron's buddy
says.
Your Barron's buddy sounds so good with this one-on-one interaction with the students and the dogs that you bring in. Sounds so effective. Bob, what are some other conventional structure or methods or mechanics people used in humane education?
Well, it's I think that it's important to point out, as somebody had asked me recently, can humane education be done without animals? And my answer is no. I mean, you can supplement humane education with materials, a program where there's follow-up materials, written videos, audio, maybe even game applications, cell phone applications and video games that promote these principles. But the core of humane education, in my opinion, and in the reading about programs around the country, is it centers around the bond between an animal and a human, and not by reading about it, but experiencing it.
This show, Animals Today, is fully sponsored by the nonprofit animal welfare organization, Advancing the Interests of Animals. Check them out at aianimals.org. That's aianimals.org. And listen, they need your financial support. If you like what we're doing here, you like what you hear, we're educating, informing listeners about animals, how they fit into our society, how we treat them, the ways people can help our animals, then consider making a small contribution to Advancing the Interests of Animals, aianimals.org. We strive to promote compassion and respect for all living beings. Thanks for tuning in to Animals Today. After the break, we're going to be talking about humane education programs in schools with Bob Ferber. Don't go away. Welcome back to Animals Today. Bob Ferber, do many public and private schools embrace the concept of and conduct humane ed programs?
Lori, I wish I could say that that's a common experience, but no. It's actually mandated, for example, in the California Education Code, that there is supposed to be a certain amount of humane education. And sadly, it's about 15 minutes per semester that a teacher is supposed to squeeze in humane education. So that's really unrealistic. After your listeners have learned a little bit more about how it works, it's not something where you just talk to kids for 10 minutes about what you think humane education is. But it is spreading, and this is the good news. Private schools tend to be a little bit more receptive to it. I think the problem or the challenge with public schools that I've experienced in other programs is a fear of bringing animals into contact with children where something could happen. In a sort of semi-joking way, the group that I blame the most for that are lawyers, of which I'm one, because we're a very litigious society, and school districts and board members of school boards are paranoid that, oh my God, you know, you're going to bring a pit bull into a school. Now, the irony of that, Lori, is that that's part of the problem with our society, and that, you know, I've actually talked to teachers and school board members about you're acting exactly what we're trying to teach kids not to do, which is labeling. You're labeling a dog as potentially vicious. You know, they'll say, you can bring a little King Charles, but don't bring the pit bull. And so, you know, we have this the need for humane education and to appreciate the value. We can't just teach children. We have to get adults and people in education and in administrations to appreciate how important this is, and that legally there are very easy ways to get around and to protect yourself for this. There's simple, you know, release of liability agreements that can be signed, and to my knowledge, virtually every program I've ever heard of, the animals that are used are what I would call kid tested. I've actually never had a negative experience in 15 years of bringing animals to schools. I think some of the funny ones, dogs that came in with gas, ones that maybe lifted their leg and had a little accident in the classroom. And I come prepared for things like that, or to joke about the dog that is smelling up the classroom. That's always been a source of humor for elementary school kids. And I'm glad I thought of that, because I want your listeners to know humane education is fun. It's something that teachers think, well, is this going to be good? And in fact, many teachers, Lori, when they invite me to a classroom, they think they're going to go off to the side and grade papers while I'm doing my thing. Invariably, the teachers end up listening, and they become so absorbed, and teachers and principals will come in and say, oh my God, I learned so much from that. That was so interesting, and that was so much fun. So it's a win-win for everybody. There's really no downside to it, but we need to have people appreciate why this is so important, and that, in fact, that there are plenty of, you know, studies, in fact, that we could talk about that later, that back up that this really is a critical component of growing up, that children experience animals and the bond between them and animals, and especially animals with differences, disabled, unwanted, the ones that supposedly nobody can really take home, and to show that, no, these are just like even the local gang member, you know, that, or the bully. You know, we have many problems with bullies in our society. Humane education is a phenomenal approach to bullying, to teach compassion and empathy for everybody in the classroom, including the bully, and that the bully, there's a reason why somebody bullies, through insecurity, through frailty, through maybe they were victims of abuse. And as children appreciate why violence happens in our society, and this is how it starts, from being mistreated, and you may turn into a bully or join a gang, this is the beginning of understanding each other. And it's really the only, in my opinion, solution to dealing with long-term solution to violence in our society.
Bob, you mentioned you're a lawyer, and indeed you spent a fair amount of your career as a prosecutor in Los Angeles. What is the relationship between humane education and the work of a district attorney?
They work very well they complement each other, but the humane education is paramount. And what I mean by that, when I became the first full-time animal cruelty prosecutor in the country, this was out of a terrible need for our society to make people accountable for abuse of animals. And When I went into it, I saw this as a huge solution to long-term problems with animal abuse. But as I did it more and became a little bit more effective and other prosecutors started to get on the bandwagon, it dawned on me that this was not a long-term solution that would prevent violence. It was something that after the fact that a friend of mine said something from a horse rescue group that I love. He said the most humane act is prevention, meaning preventing violence, preventing neglect. As you and I have talked about before, Lori, the most humane act is to spay and neuter to prevent animals from being overpopulated. So being a prosecutor is important. It's important to do prosecutions of animal abuse, but to say that that is the solution is incorrect because we're doing it after the fact, after it's already happened. What we need is critical in society is more focus and emphasis and resources on programs that prevent violence in our society. And I realized that as a prosecutor, as important as what I was doing, was having a good impact on society. We need humane education, and with effective humane education and widespread humane education in our country and around the world, we will see less need for criminal prosecutions. One of the things I want people to know is that if there is no humane education in a community or a society, people shouldn't think that we're not educating kids about relationships with people, but they're getting the wrong kind. When I went to the Los Angeles City Council to get our first animal cops from LAPD, I explained to them that, we have neighborhoods all through the city where children are getting the wrong messages because we're not teaching the positive messages through humane education. The dog fighting goes on in communities. Animals are and police cars drive by and ignore it. Children grow up in neighborhoods where dogs are lying on the street that were hit by cars. Other dogs are running in and out of traffic. There's severe overpopulation of puppies that are in alleys that have no food or water, and people ignore it. They are getting messages over and over again that it's okay to treat living creatures this way. And studies have shown overwhelmingly that people see the link between animal abuse, the way we treat animals and the way we treat people. So if children are exposed to violence against animals and neglect, and they don't see any consequences, we're teaching them the opposite of what we want to teach them. Through humane education, we're teaching them that you don't have to be compassionate, you don't have to be empathetic, you don't have to provide peaceful solutions to disputes, that it's okay, that life is cheap. And what does that lead to? That leads to domestic violence, bullying. On the adult level, it can lead to more serious crimes of violence. And I really, it's not an exaggeration that these people, as children grow up, they become politicians, elected officials. And these are the people that, excuse my readers, that's my animals. These are the leaders of our communities that create war. And I'm not one of those, I'm not saying I'm some peacenik that we're not going to have disputes in the world, but look at the way countries treat each other. Violence is the first and almost the only reaction that each country has to a problem. And where is it learned? It's learned in as kids grow up. So humane education is so critical. Learning, it's so easy. It's so easy to bring animals into the inner city schools. And when kids then see, I've seen this over and over again, elementary school kids who come back and tell me that they told their parents that it's not right to not have their dog spayed or neutered. It's not right to have their dog off leash. And mommy, why don't we walk the dog with a leash? And how come we let Spot or Fluffy run through traffic? Or how come we haven't brought our cat to the vet because he's got a broken leg? And, I've had children who, out of humane education, I've had parents call me and say, my kid said that I can't use Crest toothpaste because they're cruel to animals, and that I have to use Tom's of Maine toothpaste. And, these parents change. So in an extraordinary way, humane education leads children to teach adults even how to be more compassionate and empathetic.
Very good. After the break, how do we know humane education is effective? Is there evidence that humane education programs really influence our youth? Don't go away. This is Animals Today. Welcome back to Animals Today. Bob Ferber, according to the National PTA Congress, quote, children trained to extend justice, kindness, and mercy to animals become more just, kind, and considerate in their relations with each other. Character training along these lines will result in men and women of broader sympathies, more humane, more law-abiding in every respect, and more valuable citizens, end quote. Now, Bob, clearly, most people in the business in humane education believe this to be true. They want it to be true. But what does the science really tell us? How much scientific research is there that looks at the effectiveness of various humane education programs in really influencing our youth?
That's an excellent question, and I think it's critical to answer that before society is going to accept this as mainstream education for everyone. Years ago, you know, we all experienced years ago these stories about Jeffrey Dahmer, the horrible man who, you know, dismembered victims, and when he was a child, dismembered animals. And that was the beginning of, you know, I think a public recognition that there is a link between violence against animals and violence against people. And that continued on. This is kind of a little brief history of how this started. And then people realized more and more in law enforcement, or actually in the medical profession, that men who beat their women in domestic violence situations often had a history of violence against animals, or they experienced it as they were growing up. And so we started to see, originally people would say, oh, you have an animal abuse case, Bob, that means that he's a serial killer. And then later on people would say, oh, you have an animal abuse case, that means he's probably either a serial killer or beating up his wife. But as time went on, psychologists and psychiatrists and educators started to realize that it wasn't limited to any of that, that the reality was that violence against any living creature, whether your parents did it, you experience it yourself, or watch it, is going to translate into future violence against humans. But people all over have said, are there studies to show it? And as you're asking, yes, there are. In the last 10 years, I'd say, from virtually no research, just a lot of wonderful anecdotal stories, the last 10, 15 years have been overwhelming amount of studies that literally will fill a bookcase, showing the impact of humane education on children and adults. And I would direct, you know, your listeners to a wonderful website, Latham.org, LATHAM.org. The Latham letter and organization is the first and probably the leading organization in the country that highlights the link between animal abuse and violence against people, and how animals can reverse that and teach the opposite, teach compassion, empathy, and nonviolence. And virtually every month there's a study that is highlighted showing how animals have effectively done this. Your listeners to check out that website. But I can give people an example in law enforcement that we've known about for years and has been well studied. The programs in prisons where dogs are brought into prisons and violent prisoners, are taught to raise these animals, to train the so-called unwanted pit bulls and Rottweilers and rehabilitate these animals so that they can be adopted out. The studies are overwhelming, showing that instead of a 90% recidivism rate, meaning 90% of criminals end up back in prison, the recidivism rate drops to 10%. That these simple little programs where criminals work with the unwanted, disabled animals of society that are the rejects, they identify with it just the way the child in the classroom identifies in one way or another with Baron von Drooler or Amy the Pitbull. these prisoners identify, and they bond with them and change their behavior. And as they help change the behavior of the animal that makes them adoptable, the prisoners change their own behavior. And the prisoners talk about it, the studies have shown it, and more there's studies around the country that are documenting long-term studies. Shush, guys! Long-term studies that show that children and adults lead better lives and less violent lives as they go on in society. But, you know, as we can understand, documenting or proving that something that happened in elementary school definitely works and has an impact in your 30s or your 20s is not easy. So I wouldn't want to fool people into thinking that you're going to just be able to show, you know, Jose, who came to this classroom, next year he's now a wonderful new kid. You might have anecdotal stories, but these studies are backing it up, showing that 5 years later, 10 years later, we're seeing changes in behavior. But one caveat to all this, Laurie, is that we can't have more studies if we don't have more programs. There's psychologists and psychiatrists and educators out there that want to see more studies, and what you need is programs to start doing it, and people, bold educators who are willing to change, you know, the curriculum and find more than 15 minutes in a semester to bring an animal into a school and watch what happens. And so I would probably end this by saying that studies are critical, but anybody who has any doubt about this, I'd say go to that website, Latham.org, but more importantly, experience a program. Learn about a humane education program. Start your own. A good way to start is by just simply going to the Latham.org, and they have volumes of material on the Internet about different ways of doing programs. And you will see, personally, in a classroom, or even a group of adults, or in a nursing home, or a group of kids with cancer, or with a parent with cancer, kids that are in prison, you will see dramatic changes, even within minutes. I mean, it's that dramatic, Laurie. So that I've actually seen teachers tell me that within 45 minutes they've seen a dramatic change in children, and then for the remainder of the semester, their behavior has changed because of 45 minutes with a disabled animal in the classroom.
Former Los Angeles animal cruelty prosecutor and founder of Barron's Buddies, Bob Ferber. Thank you so much, Bob.
You're so welcome. And if anybody ever wants to reach me, they can reach me at animallawyer@yahoo.com.
animallawyer@yahoo.com. Thank you.
I'm happy to answer any questions or just have a discussion.
And thank you for listening to Animals Today. This is Dr. Laurie Kirshner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.